Hey, this is Duray. Welcome to Posse of the View. In this episode, it's me, Kai, DR, and Miles talking about the news that you don't know from the week before. And then I sit down with the one and only former mayor, Michael Tubbs, to discuss his new memoir, The Deeper the Roots. And the advice for this week is about grace, is that people are going through a lot. I feel like I've been through a lot. Most of the people I've been around, this has just been a hard 18, 19 months. And the reality is that a lot of people around us disappoint us or don't meet our expectations. And sometimes we disappoint ourselves and we don't meet our own expectations. So give yourself grace, give the people around you grace. And that doesn't mean sort of excusing things that hurt you or harm you, but it does mean sort of thinking more deeply about the total context and knowing that we can be kinder sometimes than we are. Here we go.
Y'all, my news this week is from the LA Times, and it kind of was serendipitous how this news came to me. I was on the phone this week with some of my Maestro team members and Naima Keith. Naima is VP of Education and Programming at LACMA, among other things. She's a brilliant curator and has been in the art space jamming for a very long time. So we were very honored to have the opportunity to speak with her. But what she brought to our attention, among many other things, brilliant things, is Destination Crenshaw, which we actually had not heard of. And so as the LA Times article points out, you know, Destination Crenshaw is a little over a mile of Crenshaw Boulevard, which is essentially going to be transformed into an arts corridor. And so it's super exciting. And I really wanted to dig in more about how this all came to be, which the article doesn't necessarily highlight, but I encourage you all to go to destinationcrenshaw.la to learn more information, because I just think this is such an incredible project that really came out of kind of a crisis in Crenshaw and then Black folks getting together to organize and then having an answer that is just going to be so compelling and I think impact so many people of all ages, all hues, actually, not just Black folks, for such a long time to come. But for y'all that don't know, Crenshaw Boulevard is really the spine of the Los Angeles Black community. And some of this I'm reading from DestinationCrenshaw.la, so I want to give them their glory on this. So Crenshaw has always been a place of dynamic expression, Black culture, Black economic development, Black economic legacy. And ultimately, the corridor and Destination Crenshaw came to be because at one point, the city was planning to put a train on Crenshaw Boulevard. And so it was planned for, you know, this train to go from through Crenshaw, really, to LAX, to the airport in Los Angeles, really slicing through the heart of, you know, this Black main thoroughfare. And we've seen this done time and time again through eminent domain in so many cities, and this has been happening over decades. And what would have happened is that if this train was put there on Crenshaw, it would have uprooted 300 business parking spaces, 400 trees, obviously impacting business, impacting culture in that thoroughfare. You know, and there's also an argument too about cultural erasure that would have happened too with this train going through Crenshaw. But as the website points out for Destination Crenshaw, Black Los Angeles had a plan and really a creative, collaborative, and community-led response to this injustice really brought this whole idea around Destination Crenshaw. So it's exciting to see that, you know, all these folks came together with the goal of one, continuing to preserve and really breathe the creativity and the resilience and the potential of this community, but also, you know, drive economic and cultural revitalization to the Crenshaw corridor. So it's just exciting to see how this has all come together. I'm so excited to see, you know, when it comes to be. It's not planned to debut until fall of 2022. Some of the artists that are participating are just, you know, top artists, top Black artists, folks like Yahinde Wiley, and they're gonna be these huge sculptures, and all of the art pieces really having meaning and contextualization in terms of Black identity, Black power, the legacy of Black folks in this country. So All that to say, check out the LA Times article. There are more details there, obviously. But also, you know, go directly to the source, destinationcrenshaw.la. Shout out to Naomi Keith again for putting us on. And we're so super excited to continue to follow this program and to be there at its debut.
My news for this week is about a new study that came out. It was profiled in Axios, and the study shows that Black offenders are more likely to get federal life sentences. Just to zoom out, remember that the federal government incarcerates the least amount of people in the system, a ton of people still, but there are about 2.3 million people incarcerated in a given day. Federal system is responsible for about 250,000 or so of those people. And what's wild about this is that the study shows that 2 out of 3 people serving life terms are defendants of color. And when you disaggregate that by race, what you find is that more than 4,800 of all offenders were eligible for life imprisonment, and almost 1,200 received life sentences. Black offenders accounted for fewer than a third of all cases, but constituted nearly half of those eligible for life sentences. That's wild. And white offenders accounted for more than a third of all cases, but constituted less than a quarter of those eligible. Now, we zoom out. These are things that people have believed for a long time. These are things that people sort of knew the inequities were baked into the system. But this study confirms so much of what people had understood before, that regardless of the offense or regardless of a host of other factors, that the overrepresentation in the system is high, but the overrepresentation and the severity of the punishment is high no matter how we track it. And the takeaway that I had for this and why I wanted to bring it is that it's a reminder that when we think about just the impact of incarceration on communities, families. You know, I was talking to somebody recently about their work on wealth, and I'm like, it is impossible to do wealth work that is not also incarceration work. Like, it is what we have done to Black and brown people is just so wild and at scale that I don't know how the other work happens without undoing it. And this is just another example for me that when you look at it, it's like Black people underrepresented in the amount of cases, but overrepresented in the punishment is just like par for the course for both how people think about this system and almost all other inequities in other systems. So wanted to bring it here, wanted people to think about it. The study was published in Criminology, in the magazine Criminology, and it is called Life Lessons, Examining Sources of Racial and Ethnic Disparity in Federal Life Sentences Without Parole. And again, a life sentence without parole means that you will be in jail forever, essentially, because there is no parole, and parole will be the way that you got out. In those places, you could technically get your sentence commuted by the governor, but that rarely happens in ways that people benefit from. So wanted to bring that here. Not the most uplifting, but true. Don't go anywhere. More Pod Save the People is coming. Pod Save the People is brought to you by DEMZ. That's DEMZ. Every day we make decisions about who we support through our votes, the products we buy, and the organizations we donate to. When a company or candidate doesn't align with our values, we usually stop supporting them, or we should. But what about our investments? Chances are many of you have investment products that track the S&P 500, which is made up of the 500 largest U.S. publicly traded companies. But what if we told you that over half of these companies make significant political donations to the GOP? In comes DEMZ. DEMZ was built by a team of researchers and finance experts who grew tired of not knowing where our money was going across investment products. Through extensive research and financial know-how, they put together a product that includes only those companies from the S&P 500 that have donated 75% or more of their political donations to Democrats, on average over the last 3 federal election cycles. Now, you can get similar exposure and hopefully the same or better performance that you would expect from the entire S&P 500 without investing in companies that may be funneling money into Matt Gaetz's Venmo account. DEMZ, D-E-M-Z, that's the ticker symbol, trades on the NASDAQ and is available through top investment houses and brokerages such as Schwab, TD Ameritrade, and Fidelity. You can finally put your money where your vote is. Search for the DEMZ ticker, that's D-E-M-Z, wherever you invest, or visit DEMZ.fund to learn more. Investing involves risk. Principal loss is possible. Carefully consider the fund's investment objectives, risk factors, charges, and expenses before investing. This and additional information can be found in the fund summary or full prospectus, which may be obtained by visiting DEMZ.fund. Please read the prospectus carefully before investing. Distributed by SEI Investments Distribution Company, which is not affiliated with Reflection Asset Management LLC, the advisor for the fund.
This episode is brought to you by Kariuma, the sustainable sneaker brand creating cool, seriously comfortable sneakers in a way that's better for you and the planet. If you told us a few months ago that we'd willingly add our name to a waitlist just to cop a pair of sneakers, we'd have figured you don't know us. That's right. The pod with the lightning fast Twitter hands has found something worth waiting for. The best news is that you, dear listener, don't have to wait another moment. Kariuma has just restocked this bestseller, the Akka. Akka comes in both a low top and a high top, featuring Kariuma's signature memory foam insoles for all day comfort. These sneakers are hand finished and come in a ton of colors, including fall ready neutrals, canvas, and suede, with colors like rose, gray, off white, and camel. Kariuma believes you and the planet deserve a better sneaker. That's why they source premium planet-conscious materials to create good-looking, unbelievably comfortable sneakers like Akka. We think they're pretty great, and so do the 26,000-plus people on this recent wait list. Ever heard of Helen Mirren, John Hamm, or Gabrielle Union? They're fans, too. Akka is available in a classic organic cotton canvas, as well as the ultra-soft, ethically sourced suede from LWG-certified suppliers, ideal for fall and winter. Low-tops are on the menu, but Kariuma sneakers also come in a high-top silhouette for a cozier fit. Kariuma ships all their sneakers free and fast in the USA and offers worldwide shipping and 60-day free returns. They deliver right to your front door using single-box recycled packaging. And for a limited time, Pod Save the People listeners can get an exclusive 15% off your pair of Kariuma sneakers. Go to Kariuma.com/PSTP to get 15% off. That's Kariuma.com/PSTP for 15% off, only for a limited time.
Festac 77 was one of my discoveries in the news. I found it on afterall.org. It was, to put it simply, it's a festival that happened in Lagos in 1977 in Nigeria. It included people like Miriam Makeba, Sana Ra, and a host of other acts that went to go perform there. I was really fascinated with this festival, not just because it was just up my alley and things that I'm interested about, but because I didn't know about it. And it reminded me of the Soul documentary that Questlove directed and produced earlier this year. And it really made me think about how many things have happened in America, in the world, in the nation, in all around the world that we do not know about, that really housed and even maybe even foreshadowed where Black culture is going and where it could go. Early in 1977, thousands of artists, writers, musicians, activists, and scholars from Africa and the Black diaspora assembled in Lagos for Festac 77, the second world Black and African festival of arts and culture. With a radically ambitious agenda underwritten by Nigeria's newfound oil wealth, Festac 77 would unfold as a complex, glorious, and excessive culmination of half a century of transatlantic and pan-Africanist cultural political gatherings. As I looked around for more information on Festac 77, it was sparse, to say the least. And there wasn't as much footage as I would want. There wasn't enough much even like conversation around it as I would want. And again, it kind of connects to No Name, the library, and research and preservation and the necessity of it. We really need to make it a point to preserve what has happened in the past, specifically the things that have happened in the past that are positive, the things that have happened in the past that make us smile or that inform us or that inspire us, because we are a people that builds on yesterday to totally make our tomorrows the best tomorrows that we can create. So we don't just create things out of nowhere, even if they are innovative and new. We create things through research and an appreciation from the past. And I think Black people, specifically American Black people, but I think Black people just globally, we are great at remembering, and it is a part of our just cultural DNA to preserve what has happened yesterday. And I think that specifically because of the access we have a great need and privilege to be able to at least attempt the preservation of what has happened in the past because we have more access to media tools, technology, and more time. A lot of us, of course, this is not everybody, but a lot of us are granted with more time to be able to sit and preserve these things. And I'm hoping that the bug of curiosity setting in on different people around things like Festag 77 in Nigeria and other festivals that maybe I do not know the name of. And that is my news.
My news this week comes from Queen Anne's County, Maryland, which is a small county on the eastern shore of Maryland. And it comes to us from the front lines of school leadership. As many of you know, I'm a former school superintendent. I ran DC Public Schools for 6 years. And the superintendency is a job that I think lots of people know intellectually that it is a very difficult job. But I don't think that people have a real insight into how difficult the job is. And I wanted to lift this story up because it's about a woman named Dr. Andrea Kane. And Dr. Kane is the first African-American superintendent of Queen Anne's County Schools. It's a high-performing district, and it was a dream come true for her to become a superintendent. And this woman who had, you know, more than 20 years of education experience took on might even be too affirmative a word, but she wrote a letter to her community in the wake of the killings of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor and Ahmaud Arbery, inviting people to conversation, calling out anti-Black racism and inviting people to conversation about how they are going to deal with this in their school system. And she says, she wrote, "Black Lives Matter," and then everything just imploded. It turns out that her writing this letter created a year-long firestorm of negative engagement with a certain segment of community members in her area, and ultimately resulted in her resigning from the superintendency. And I bring this to the pod. I bring this article to the pod because I think that it's really important for people to understand, number one, that leaders, school leaders, any kind of leaders, are people and are deeply feeling the events that are happening. I also think it's important because as a school leader, we have to help our young people understand and make sense of what's going on around them. And that's the thing that Dr. Kane tried to do. She tried to, like many educators across the country, use the George Floyd moment to recommit the district to goals around racial justice and to help students make sense of what they were seeing on the news and in the world. And so in service of that goal, Dr. Kane helped to support young people who wanted to protest and have conversation and discussion. She supported a group of folks who were coming together in a Sunday dinner environment to talk about systemic racism in their district. She actually had evidence. There had been reports done about disproportionate youth representation in Queen Anne's County. Black students make up only 6% of the student body, but they are overrepresented in arrests and sanctions in the districts, in suspensions in the district, in dropout rates, and in educational attainment. In fact, she called Black students in Queen Anne's County underserved and overdisciplined. And in response to this, a group of parents who call themselves the Kent Island Patriots decided to take Dr. Kane on. They called for her resignation. They protested. They did all of these things. They showed up at school board meetings and made school board meetings untenable. In fact, they ran a slate of candidates to defeat existing school board members so that they could have a majority share of the school board votes. And they were successful in that. In fact, once they attained a majority on the school board, they began to turn back some of the policies that were put in place to support diversity, equity, and inclusion. And This group, the Kent Island Patriots, actually is indicative of a movement across America. There's another article in the Washington Post this week about Moms for Liberty, and it is the title of the article is Moms for Liberty has turned parental rights into a rallying cry for conservative parents. Yes, all over the country, we are seeing conservative parents like the Kent Island Patriots or Moms for Liberty who are standing up, according to them, against the government to determine what is taught in schools, to determine who gets to teach and lead. And their mantra is, we don't co-parent with the government. And this is, in some cases, it looks like these are small and isolated incidents across the United States. But in fact, the Washington Post article goes on to point out that these kinds of conservative parent groups have been the most disruptive to the educational environment that many folks have seen in decades. And in fact, this is actually a precursor to what we should expect to see in the midterm elections and beyond. In fact, that this is a grassroots organizing campaign for the Republican Party, similar to the moral majority of the 80s or the Tea Party in the 2010 elections. And especially in Florida, where Moms for Liberty started, they are seeing huge increases in Republican voter registration. In fact, they've been trying, it's a way to now engage 20 and 30 year old females in the Republican Party in ways that they've never been before. Come with me back to Queen Anne's County, where Dr. Kane, the superintendent, is not only the superintendent trying to lead in a time where this conversation about race is incredibly fraught and fractious, but in fact, she's trying to support her students in their conversations. There are teachers who came to Queen Anne's, which again is a high-performing district, in part because of her leadership and because of her willingness to take on issues of equity. And, you know, there were groups of people who rallied to support Dr. Kane. And Dr. Kane is an African-American woman, a mother of two sons. And so our leadership is not just professional. Our leadership is often personal. And so could you imagine being an African-American woman leading in this particular time and being attacked for your beliefs about or for your advocacy to ensure that every student in your school district is represented, to ensure that we learn to treat one another with empathy and compassion, to ensure that every student is treated fairly across your district. And ultimately, that ends up wearing on you as a person. And so, you know, ultimately, as these the Kent Island Patriot parents continue to gain more and more ground, Dr. Kane ended up resigning. She watched them reinstate people who had made racist comments and had been fired. She watched them abandon critical initiatives that were put in place to support diversity, equity, and inclusion across the district. And ultimately, she actually said, they made her feel subhuman. They hung me out and stripped me bare. And so I bring this to the pod because it is a tragedy of leadership for me. Only 2% of the nation's superintendents are Black, and many people are quitting in response to these kinds of backlashes to DEI efforts. And I would contend that we need good leadership and we need representative leadership. And we need to make sure that things like what happened to Dr. Kane don't happen to any other superintendent. Again, we have, as a community, the ability to determine who leads and how they lead and how we support them. And we need to be vigilant in this particular time as we protect school leaders and the job that they are doing.
Hey, you're listening to Pod Save the People. Stay tuned. There's more to come.
Quick question. Are you politically engaged and spiritually exhausted? If you said yes to both, welcome home. I'm Erin Ryan.
And I'm Alyssa Mastromonaco.
And we're the hosts of Hysteria, the podcast for women who care about democracy, culture, and not losing their minds in the process.
We break down the news, call out the nonsense, and spotlight the women actually fighting back on Capitol Hill, in classrooms, and everywhere the stakes are high.
It's sharp, honest analysis featuring women's voices with humor and zero handholding.
Listen to Hysteria wherever you get your podcasts and watch full episodes on YouTube.
And now my conversation with former Mayor Michael Tubbs. He's one of the youngest mayors in U.S. history and also is the author of The Deeper the Roots. Today, we talk about blackness, about burnout, and where to find hope. Here we go.
Mayor Tubbs, thanks so much for joining us today on Posse of the People.
Thank you so much for having me. Always good to be in conversation with you, brother.
Now, what is your world like? We first met what feels like forever ago. We're both young and it still feels like we've lived a couple lifetimes. When you were the mayor of Stockton, what's going on in your world today?
I have two children now. I have a 2-year-old and I have a child who was born August 30th. So my wife and I are parents of two children, under two and under, which is a lot of fun. We've relocated to Los Angeles. In addition to the book, I'm a special advisor to Governor Newsom on economic mobility and opportunity. As a part of that work, next year we're launching an initiative called Ending Poverty in California, which we really focus on how we make the Golden State actually golden for everyone, which I'm excited about. I've been doing some narrative stuff, like getting more into storytelling, and then enjoying the beach and kind of enjoying time with my family.
I love it. How is this your first time living in LA, and how is that different than living in Stockton, or like, what is it like to live in a different place than you've lived for such a long time?
Yeah, I only have ever lived in Stockton outside of the 4 years in college. So moving to a different city was difficult, but in many ways, I think it was necessary because it's given me the time and space to actually reflect on my time in Stockton, reflect on Stockton as a place and think about sort of all the lessons, the wins, the losses that come from there. And LA is just amazing. We live in South LA, which has more Black people than anywhere else out west of the Mississippi. I love all of our elected officials. I love the art, the culture. I think it's going to be a nice place to raise our kids. It almost feels like a renaissance of sorts is happening. In LA, and particularly in South LA, so it's been really good to be here. And my best friend lives 10 minutes away. My wife's maid of honor, her best friend lives 10 minutes away. So it's really good to be in a place where we have sort of friends that are our age, because in Stockton, many of my friends were older, which is fun. But I mean, most 26, 27 year olds aren't kicking with 50 year olds all day. So it's good to be right in a place where there's folks around our age who are also having kids, who are also upwardly mobile, et cetera, to be our friend as one of those who are a little bit older and more seasoned.
I love it. Now, you have a book that is coming out, The Deeper the Roots, A Memoir of Hope, and happy to talk about the book. I have a copy so that I could talk to you today, but it's not out yet, is it?
No, it comes out November 16th. So you can pre-order from independent bookstores, from anywhere books are sold. But the book and the audiobook comes out November 16th.
Got it. That's what I thought. I was like, I have it, though. Let's jump into it. Is the book starts with an introduction to your mom in a lot of ways. Like, she's such a big part of the first chapter in our introduction to you. I'd love to know, like, why is that so? How would you describe your mother's role in your life? She is named She Daddy in the book. And can you just give us a glimpse into why?
Yeah, my mom is the most... one of the most interesting people, I think, because I find her to be so influential and so, but she's so quiet. She doesn't take up a lot of space. She doesn't, which is funny being my mom, she doesn't like to talk. She doesn't like interviews. She actually doesn't like attention. And she thinks that everything, she's like, well, what's the big deal? Like, this is what I'm supposed to do as a mother, et cetera. And I thought it was important to talk about her from the beginning because so much of what she had been taught and socialized was this idea that her story, her struggles, her strengths and her weaknesses weren't worthy to be shared. That those things should not be talked about. That it wasn't her, who she was, her dreams, her aspirations, her experiences didn't matter. They were just life. So it's important for me to start with her, because I just remember growing up, her adage was like, don't tell anyone our business. And I don't think it was just about being embarrassed. I think it was about sort of too much information can be weaponized against you, or that no one actually really cares about what you, about who you are. They just care about what you do. And I think it was important to start with her, to show her, like, no, mom, our stories are valuable, that we're worth being talked about, that we're worth being discussed, that we're worth being emulated in some ways.
And what about Auntie Tasha?
Yeah, so I was really blessed in that, in addition to my mom, who had me very young, she was in high school when I was born, my aunt and my grandmother, my nana, they were all sort of like a triple wall of mothers. So my aunt is super important in my life and in the book, because she was sort of like, my mom's really hard. Like, she's not a very soft or sentimental person, even though she's very sensitive. But she's very, like, hard, tough. She's single mom raising two black boys. And really embraces this notion of being very hard and almost calloused in a way, and not really soft. But my aunt is the opposite. She's a big teddy bear. She's super emotional. She's a cryberry baby. She's super, like, loving, and she loves people, and she's very social, and she's very talkative. And she was also equally had a role in raising me. And she was just incredibly important as a help to my mom, but also just her real emphasis on education, educational opportunities, always buying me, like, charging a bunch of books on her credit card so I would have things to read. And she was always sort of a constant in my life, as well as my grandmother, who was the real spiritual grounding and the real kind of spiritual stalwart, and was really the matriarch of our family, and made sure we were in church, made sure we were taking care of, made sure that we learned what it meant to serve and to be a part of community. I think all three of them were necessary for me to become the person I'm becoming. And I wanted this book to also be an ode to them and black women and black mothers like them who are saving democracy, raising kids, and doing all the things.
And, you know, you talk about your father's proximity and sort of inclusion in the criminal justice system in a host of ways in the book, and his time being incarcerated. How did that influence your work as mayor? How has that shaped the way that you think about the system and your relationship with the family?
Yeah, I actually, the older I get, the more I am reflective and the more I'm appreciative of sort of what I've learned from having a father who's been incarcerated the most 90%+ of my life. And I think one of the things I've learned, and it's a journey, because I think growing up, part of it was a motivation to be the best. Part of it was this idea of pulling myself on my bootstraps and proving everyone wrong, and sort of being afraid to make any mistake, being afraid to not be perfect, being afraid to be human and fallible. But then as I got older, I realized that it wasn't necessarily just his actions, but sort of the actions of policymakers. He was incarcerated under the three strikes law. And his last strike wasn't that he murdered somebody. It wasn't that he had even harmed a woman or a child. He robbed somebody, but he robbed a rival drug dealer to pay for my sister's funeral, right? Like, and I think that context I didn't have growing up. And when I learned that, I remember being like, oh my gosh, I had written this person off as this monster. When he's a guy who made a terrible decision, but isn't a monster or a serial killer or anything like that. But I think in terms of my approach, it's really illustrated to me, A, the power of redemption, the power of second chances. And so much of my work as mayor was focused on sort of preventing violence, but also providing on-ramps for folks who may have caused harm, who are now out, to be part of the solution. I've spent so much time as mayor in San Quentin and other prisons, Folsom and others, talking to incarcerated folks and talking about how much we needed them to be part of the community when they come back. And I think a part of that work was rooted in sort of just, in a way, my father. And I also would say that a lot of the work we did on prevention in terms of education, in terms of the universal scholarship program, was also rooted in this notion that I wanted to prevent kids from feeling like they had to sort of go on past at least that outcome. And lastly, I would say, I think to the chagrin of other people, because I knew people would kind of use my story and try to use it to demonize people and would love for me to be the face of sort of tough on crime, the face of cruelty, the face of lock them up. And I just refused to do that. And I was very, very cognizant of using the fact that my father was incarcerated to have a different conversation, a conversation of redemption, a conversation of how incarceration destroys families and communities, a conversation about all that's wasted in prison, and a conversation about how those who are in prison, those who are returning from prison, have an outside influence on the safety of our community. We should probably be more intentional about how we invest and engage in them.
That makes sense to me. I'll come back to your family in a moment. I was also really struck by the role that school played in the way you thought about possibility, and you write about Langston Hughes Academy being so transformative. Can you talk about the role that school and teachers or just the education setting played in shaping your life?
And I know you appreciate this as an educator, but growing up, I loved school, but I hated teachers. Like, I love school. I love the social part. I love the student groups. I love the hallways. I love the drama. I loved going to school. I hated teachers. I hated being in class. But I think I have the language for it now, but after getting my master's in education policy and serving as an educator for 3 years myself, I realized that part of what I hated was racism and microaggressions. I hated sort of my identity being weaponized or used as a reason for teachers to be suspicious of whether I did the work myself or not, or for being kicked out for asking questions, or for refusing or fighting back to tropes around how folks who weren't in advanced classes were going to be in prison or going to be pumping our gas someday, as teachers would tell us, or that being Black meant you weren't in calculus, that to be a Black person in calculus, you had to be actually not Black. Or you're so, and that stuff used to bother me. So I was kicked out all the time. But then before college, I spent a summer as a like student aide, but ended up actually being ended up being like an eighth grade teacher for the summer. And I realized that, wow, that a caring adult, an adult who cares, an adult who has love and empathy and believes in the dignity of all students can have an impact. And I saw sort of in my students, my family, myself, a lot of my friends who didn't make it to college, et cetera. And that's why I became convinced that sort of changing the cast of characters in a school system, in a school district, in a classroom really matters. And that's when I thought at the time I would be like a superintendent one day. And I think even now the stories of my students are what inspire me. And I just realized again that talent and intellect are universal, but resources and opportunities are not.
And you became an activist in college, right? Did I get that right? Like, is that where you first
In high school, I did some stuff. Like, I was in the ACP. So I remember first big campaign was the Tukey Williams death penalty campaign in high school. I did, like, some student government stuff. But then in college, that's where I really became sort of, to your point, more of a bit more activism in terms of not being part of a formal institution, not being part of an institution trying to make change. So my first week in college, or first month, I led a protest at City Hall against racial profiling in Palo Alto. And this is in 2008. And I think you would appreciate it just given your work. But we were having conversations then that sadly were still conversations that were happening 10 years later, like around sort of stops and traffic stops and being dispersed in Black folks in terms of, I remember they said their training, the training program of the police department in 2008 was going to the Holocaust Museum. And that was like the extent, and watching the movie Crash. And I remember being 19 and freshman and saying, surely this is not the extent of your police officer training. And even then I realized that there was this, it mattered who was in the room, who was asking the questions, who was pushing, and who was being provocative. And that was my first time, although I know that would be a prelude to sort of the role I would play, not as an activist, but as someone, as a leader in the political system. But it was those early experiences. I remember organizing Occupy Stanford protests, which I think is to speak to a lot in the book, but leading Occupy Stanford protests during my Rhodes Scholarship weekend, I was leading a protest with Berkeley students before the big game, protesting police brutality. So it was really, looking back, it was really interesting to see how so many of those experiences were really kind of crumbs or clues as to what I would spend most of my 20s doing, albeit from a different vantage point. Well, last story I'll tell you, I remember in 2014 being out in city council and being on the U.S. one-on-one blocking traffic to protest the murder of Michael Brown. And I remember being incredibly nervous because I was on city council. And I was in Palo Alto, so I was working at Stanford as a fellow at the time. And I remember being super nervous and almost not doing it because I was like, well, what if I get arrested? Like, what does that look like for the councilman in Stockton to be breaking a law, blocking traffic in Palo Alto? So I think that the activism experiences and sort of that leadership training was super formative and very instructive.
You know, I feel like the last time we talked about your time as mayor and in 2020 and not winning re-election. One of the things that you write in the book is I was often too busy with reality to worry about politics. How do you reflect on that period of your life, which you're so young that I can only imagine that you'll be elected to something else if you want to in the future. But what does that sentence mean? And, you know, how do you reflect on both that time, but also such an incredible run that you did have as mayor of Stockton?
Yeah, politics is like a really weird, it's almost like entertainment. It's almost like a very performative. And I really struggled with that part because all this work was personal to me. So I don't want to do anything if I just thought it was going to have an impact. And I just spent all my time and all my energy focused on the hard things, moving, pushing. And I just didn't care about how it would be perceived, or which is stupid because you have to care at some point to get votes. But that just really wasn't my focus. And particularly in 2020, I mean, you had the protests against the murder of George Floyd. You had kind of COVID-19. And you have the other stuff that come with running a city. So I just really didn't pay too much attention to sort of those things. So I was really focused on setting up testing sites. I was really focused on getting a mask mandate. I was really focused on making sure my folks had food and setting up food distribution systems and making sure our nonprofits could stay open and our small businesses had support. And I was naive enough to think that just the work would be enough, that we would do such a good job that even if folks didn't like me, or like my politics, they couldn't argue with the end result. And that's what I think is needed more so now in our politics. Is we just need leaders who do what they have with the time they're given. And if they're given more time, fine. But then that's 4 years, how long you have, actually govern, actually do. Because I think to be reelected, it was very clear what I needed to do. I needed to do nothing. I needed to just show up at ribbon cutting. I needed to demonize poor people. I needed to talk tough to young Black kids and tell them to pull up their pants and tell them I'm going to lock you up. Like, and I just refused to play that game. And I thought sort of the work of governing, the reality of the problems we're facing would be enough to overcome that. But unfortunately, in that instance, it wasn't.
Now, given that experience that you lived through, what does that say for like the future of politics? Like, what do you think that means? Do you think that it'll right-size itself to politics not being as performative? And I do think that, you know, Trump did so much to damage any sense of, I don't know, integrity that people saw in the political space. But do you think it'll right-size itself? How do we get there? What does that look like?
I think the work that you and others like you are doing are so important. But I mentioned this earlier in terms of what I'm interested in now. So much of this is a narrative game. And what did it for me was while governing, while kind of doing things, and not perfect, but doing a damn good job. Part of it was that there's another group of people who weren't governing, who didn't have to govern, who just created a disinformation site and just spent 4 years every single day making up lies and putting money behind it and manipulating the Facebook algorithm. So it became the news for Stockton. It was just fires and homelessness and Tubbs is investigated. And Tubbs is, like, they would file complaints with the Fair Political Practice Commission to say Tubbs is being investigated. When I was never investigated, but they were just filing claims for them to look and see if I should be investigated. Like, stuff like that. And I think what it tells us about our politics is that as a body politic, we have to be more, we have to demand more of not just our elected leaders, but our information ecosystem. Like, we have to support local news. We have to have a politics and a governance that allows for dissent for sure, but also is fact-based. Because what you have, and we see it in the presidential elections, we see it in congressional elections, we see it in local elections, that scrupulous actors are just spending $50,000, $100,000 on Facebook and really distorting reality in a way that has impact on electoral outcomes. And until we address that, they're going to keep getting politicians to spend all their time acting like they're doing something. Like, look at our friend, the senator from Arizona. She got elected playing a role. She got elected acting like she was someone who cared about working people, who was going to fight for folks, who was going to be part of the coalition to deliver the Build Back Better agenda. And she's been out. She's the reason why we don't kind of have nice things. Her and Joe Manchin at this moment is because our people are so busy. People are so distracted. It's easy just to manipulate, play a game, vote one way, perform another. That's always been part of politics. But now it's become so central. It's scary because we're facing like real existential crises as a democracy. And we need like governance, leadership, things to be done and not like performing this stuff. Like case in point, I know you appreciate this. We had the nation on brink the summer of 2020. You had all the Democratic representatives in the House and Senate wear kente cloth and kneel in honor of the murder of George Floyd. But we have seen no legislation. And their job is to legislate. And I get Republican opposition. I get the politics, but I mean, that for me, that's what's frustrating. And that for me, that's the type of politics I won't do. Like, I'm not going to kneel and put on kente cloth unless I know I'm going to get this policy passed, because I think it's disrespectful when we do those things and then don't deliver.
I get it. Yes. And it has been wild to watch the past sort of year turn into a place where, you know, now people are nervous to talk about crime because it's this whole fear around the crime rate rising and, you know, we'll see what happens there. But I wanted to ask you as we close, I asked this of you before, but what's a piece of advice that you've gotten over the years that stuck with you?
The piece of advice I've gotten, I know it's right, is the idea of taking opportunities to rest and to reflect and to be very judicious about how you spend time. That the busy Olympics is a losing sport. That you really have to be intentional about where your time goes, where your energy goes, because you're just not here to work. You're here to live and to enjoy and to do things that make you happy and to spend time with the people you love. So, I mean, it's easier said than done. So I think I've been, particularly after the election, I've been doing a better job of being less busy, of being more intentional about where I spend time, and not feeling the need to prove everything all the time, but just to be, and that's enough.
Tell people where they can get the book and remind people of the book's title.
Yeah, the book is called The Deeper the Roots. It's out November 16th. Please pre-order anywhere books are sold, your local independent bookstore, Powell's Books, Black-owned bookstores for sure. You can go to, it's on Amazon, which I know a lot of y'all go and shop. Right, it's on the Audible. It's an audio book as well. The Deeper the Roots by Michael Tubbs, November 16th.
Awesome. Well, you're the man. We always consider you a friend of the pod. Can't wait to have you back.
Love you too, man. Thanks so much for having me.
Well, that's it. Thanks so much for tuning in to Pod Save the People this week. Tell your friends to check it out. Make sure to rate it wherever you get your podcast, whether it's Apple Podcasts or somewhere else. And we'll see you next week. Pod Save the People is a production of Crooked Media. It's produced by Brock Wilbur and mixed by Bill Lands. Our executive producers, Jessica Cordova-Kramer and myself. Special thanks to our weekly contributors, Kai Henderson, D.R. Ballinger, and Samuel Sinyangwe.
Question. Are you politically engaged and spiritually exhausted?
If you said yes to both, welcome home. I'm Erin Ryan.
And I'm Alyssa Mastromonaco.
And we're the hosts of Hysteria, the podcast for women who care about democracy, culture, and not losing their minds in the process.
We break down the news, call out the nonsense, and spotlight the women actually fighting back on Capitol Hill, in classrooms, and everywhere the stakes are high.
It's sharp, honest analysis featuring women's voices with humor and zero hand-holding.
Listen to Hysteria wherever you get your podcasts and watch full episodes on YouTube.